boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And the people in the houses all went to the university, where they all were put in boxes, little boxes all the same. And there's doctors and there's lawyers and business executives, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same. And they all play on the golf course and drink their martini dry, and they all have pretty children, and the children go to school, and the children go to summer camp, and then to the university, where they all get put in boxes and they all come out the same. And the boys go into business and marry and raise a family, and they all get put in boxes, little boxes all the same. There's a green one and a pink one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
Hello and welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program includes Speaking of Faith by American Public Media, The Moral Math of Climate Change from December 10, 2009, a conversation about climate change and moral imagination with a leading environmentalist and writer, Bill McKibben. The interview explores his evolving perspective on human responsibility in a changing natural world. This is about 50 minutes. And then after that, from the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen, Denmark, on December 18, 2009, President Barack Obama. President Barack Obama addresses the world's leaders at COP15. This is about 11 minutes. And then after that, Field Notes from a Catastrophe, Man, Nature, and Climate Change by Elizabeth Kohlberg. This is about 27 minutes.
We organized a camp in Africa for young people to sort of learn to be climate organizers. Many of these kids had never left their country before. Most of them had never been on an airplane, but they came. They went back home and did amazing work. So we didn't hear from the two sisters, 19 and 20, who had come from Ethiopia. We didn't hear from them for a couple of months because the internet connection is no good in Ethiopia. It's hard. But we got a call about 3 weeks before our big day saying, it's going great. Every high school in Addis Ababa now is studying global warming this fall because, you know, we've built this curriculum for them and they're all learning about 350 and it's going great. We're going to have a big event. Then we didn't hear for another 2 weeks. The day before our big global day of action, we got a sort of panicked, giddy call from them saying, look, we've got 15,000 people in the streets in Addis Ababa, and we got, you know, huge pictures from 300 rallies across India and 300 across China, from mosques all over the Middle East. One of the ones that really made me almost weep was along the shores of the rapidly dwindling Dead Sea. The Israelis made a giant human three. The Palestinians on their beach, an enormous human five. The Jordanians along their seashore, a big zero. We got a plane up and got pictures of all three of them, making the point that we're going to have to work across borders of all kinds to try to make this sort of change happen.
And you've written about cities where people are, as you say, living more lightly on the earth, where people have communally created different models.
Yes. I spent a lot of time for a book that I wrote called Hope, Human, and Wild. Mm-hmm. And so one was this city in Brazil called Curitiba.
Right.
I don't think there was anybody particularly environmental there. They were mostly concerned with making life decent for poor people, average people. The mayor, who was an architect, took a lawn chair and put it down at the nearest bus stop to City Hall. And he sat there for a day trying to figure out why buses were slow. And what he figured out was that it was that moment that it, you know, the 20 seconds it took to walk up the stairs, put your quarter in the box, and go sit down. He sketched and quickly had built this series of what they called tube stations, these elevated platforms across the city. You'd put your coin in and walk up the steps and wait for the bus. And when it came, the doors opened like the doors on a subway, and you could get 20 people a second on and off. So it was that mix of technological insight, but more importantly, social insight.
Right.
We're going to make the public more important than the private, that really worked. And what do you know? The result was that people really came to love living in that place. When he left office, when he was term limited out of office, he had a 94% approval rating. People would send delegations from other Brazilian cities saying, will you move to our city and run for mayor there?
You know, the story you just told reminds me of something we've come across as we've as I've tried to talk to people about issues around environment and ecology. We did a program where I interviewed Majora Carter, who I'm sure you know, who has revitalized, created Sustainable South Bronx, and also Cal DeWitt, who I know you
yes.
because I've read you writing about him, who has been creating a sustainable environment and community in the Wisconsin
wetlands.
In the wetlands, right, of Wisconsin. So two very different places. We ended up calling that program Discovering Where We Live because it wasn't an abstract notion of environmentalism that changed these communities. It wasn't that kind of holistic approach to life and to shared life that then environmentalism becomes this linchpin.
Here's a statistic that I really like, okay?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that everybody, all environmentalists and things have been happy about in the last couple of years is this explosion of interest in local food, right?
Right.
Because, you know, in just if for no other reason, it takes a lot less energy to move a tomato 5 miles than 5,000 miles. And not coincidentally, it tastes better. I mean, I traveled 2,000 miles yesterday. I know how I feel. That's also how the tomato feels.
Right. But, exactly.
But the real reason that's so interesting that we like farmers markets, I think, turns out to be they're different. A pair of sociologists followed shoppers first through the supermarket, then through the farmers market. Everybody's been to the supermarket. You know how it works. You walk in. You fall into a light fluorescent trance. You visit the stations of the cross around the perimeter of the supermarket. You emerge with your items. That's it. When they followed people around the farmer's market, they were having, on average, 10 times as many conversations per visit. Okay? Cheap fossil fuel, you know, heated the planet. It made us rich, but it also, maybe most profoundly, made us the first kind of our species who have had no practical need of our neighbors for anything. We tell ourselves, you know, what a great chic thing we've invented, the farmer's market. In fact, that's how all human beings shopped for food until 50 years ago, and 80% of the planet still does.
Yeah.
No wonder it feels good. I mean, this is what we're built for.
Find other conversations that echo and build on Bill McKibben's ideas with Majora Carter, Cal DeWitt, and Wangari Maathai by subscribing to our podcast or reading our staff blog, SOF Observed. Also, check out the images we've selected after culling through thousands that 350.org gathered from around the world. Find links to all this and more at speakingoffaith.org. After a short break, Bill McKibben on Job and climate change, also more on his correlation between strengthening human community and healing the environment.
In the end, it's strong communities that are efficient, that replace consumptive pleasure with deep human pleasure, that allow us to imagine a future that actually works.
I'm Krista Tippett. Stay with us. Speaking of Faith comes to you from American Public Media.
Speaking of Faith is supported by the Fetzer Institute, sponsor of Karen Armstrong's Charter for Compassion. You can learn more at Fetzer.org. And by Mendenhall Associates, supporting healthcare through information, communication, and the arts.
Welcome back to Speaking of Faith, Public Radio's conversation about religion, meaning, ethics, and ideas. I'm Krista Tippett, today with Bill McKibben on the moral math of climate change. Bill McKibben has been ahead of our cultural learning curve on the environment since he left the New Yorker magazine for the Adirondacks and wrote The End of Nature in 1989. He's since written widely about the holistic challenges of human responsibility in a changing natural world, from population to planning to community. And he's founded 350.org, an international climate campaign that seeks solutions, as he puts it, that both science and justice demand. I've followed Bill McKibben as an environmental expert for decades, but I was intrigued as I began to read the sweep of his work preparing for this interview by how overtly theological his reflection has also always been. There was robust participation of religious people and organizations in the October 2009 Planetary Day of Action organized by 350.org, from students at Billy Graham's alma mater to women in hijab in Yemen. Bill McKibben notes with pleasure that the Torah portion for that day happened to be from the story of Noah. He describes himself as a reasonably orthodox practicing Methodist. And he likes to tell of a pivotal moment in his own thinking when he read Stephen Mitchell's translation of the biblical book of Job and found a whole new way to think about God, humanity, and the natural world.
Well, Job is, you know, of all the books of the, certainly of the Hebrew Bible, for me, the by far the most powerful and interesting. Everybody knows the story. Job finds himself cursed by God. He's lying on a dung heap at the edge of town, covered with oozing sores. His flocks are dead. His family's dead. He's, you know, he's in a world of hurt. And his friends arrive to help him work through this. And he keeps lamenting what's going on and calling it unjust. And his friends keep saying, oh, no, no, it's, you know, you sinned or one of your children sinned. That's, you know, this is how it works. And that's why you're being punished. And Job, much to his credit, is not the patient Job of legend. He keeps demanding that God appear and explain why this thing has happened to him. And God finally does. And I think the soliloquy that God delivers in the last three chapters of Job, I think is the longest sustained speech that God gives anywhere in the Bible,
that's
Old Testament
true,
or New.
Yeah.
And it's a remarkably interesting speech because it doesn't answer any of the questions that Job has set out. Instead, God gives this incredibly beautiful, biologically accurate, crunchy, sexy tour of the physical universe, all the kind of interesting animals and, you know, and in very wild terms, you know. Do you hunt, he asked Job, do you hunt prey for the lion and her cubs? You know, do you help the vulture find carrion on which to feast? If you're so smart, you tell me, where do I keep the wind? Can you tell the proud waves, here you shall break and no further? Do you know where the storms are, the warehouse for the storms? Well, you know, after listening to this for two or three chapters, Job basically says, sorry I asked, you know, and
it is all about the majesty of nature, all the analogies there.
The message seems to be, Job, you're not the center of things. The sort of your questions about justice and things are kind of puny. You're a small part of something very large and beautiful, and that should be enough. And for Job, it appears to be enough. So the shocking part in reading it now is realizing that for the first time in human history, we're no longer in the position Job's in. So now we just spit right back at, you know, can you tell the proud waves where to break? Hell yes. We think we're going to raise the level of the ocean a couple of meters in the course of this century, you know. Do you know where the storms are kept? Yeah, we're pushing cyclones one after another across the Pacific. You know, we've got our thumb on the scale. In a very short order, we got very, very big. Human beings have always been in Job's position, small. And our job is to figure out how to get smaller again. And I think it's essentially a theological task, at least as much as anything else.
But it occurs to me that we do right now have some power. We are right now powerfully affecting the natural world. And so there would be a theological question about what that says about God.
Hey, I don't think there's even that. I mean, what did Oppenheimer, you know, watched the first explosion at Alamogordo and quoted from the Gita, we are become as gods, destroyers of worlds, you know. That's where we are right now.
That's where we are right now. But isn't the point of this, I mean, ultimately we render through this power, we seem to be set to render, as you said, civilization impossible. And maybe polar bears will never come back, for example. But isn't a possible outcome of this that nature wins?
Perhaps. Look, 2 billion years from now or something, the sun explodes, and if you back up and take a long enough view of it, none of it makes any difference anyway, mm-hmm. right? I find it hard to back up that far. I lack the necessary whatever it is.
Okay.
You know, we're children of the late Pleistocene. We're born with this suite of flora and fauna around us. It seems to me a good life's work to try to keep some of it intact, especially since, you know, in the course of bringing it down, many other theological and moral problems become involved. The billions of people who did nothing to cause this problem who are going to suffer grievously and already are. The huge suite of the rest of the world's DNA that we're taking down with us. Anybody who has any sense that the Earth might be in some way a museum of divine intent, you know. We're just willy-nilly running through the halls, slashing at the paintings, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So there's all kinds of deep problems raised. And there's, you know, the sort of answers that people sometimes give are in another sense theological. I mean, there are people who say, well, then our response to this should be to become even more powerful and better gods at doing it. Let's figure out how to manage everything, put a big dome over the planet, you know, mm-hmm. whatever. I think that physically it's not possible to do that. And I also think it's at some level there's something, you know, silly and ignoble and almost blasphemous about trying it.
Mm.
I think that the response we need is to figure out how to restrain ourselves, how to pull ourselves in. It strikes me that religious thinking back at least as far as the Buddha and probably farther has centered mostly on the idea that we become most fully human when we don't put ourselves at the center of everything.
I asked you a little while ago to talk about some really really basic information that people could use to begin to wrap their minds around this. And I want to ask you a similar question. Again, there's lots of conflicting information about what one can do that is helpful. And, right, you know, one year it's drive a hybrid and the next year it's not. One year it's we can create alternative sources for fossil fuel and then the next year that's just as bad for the universe. Recycling is good. Recycling doesn't matter. So where would you want to propose a different way to start thinking about what one can do?
Sure. No, I mean, burning fossil fuel is the root of this problem. And so ways that we can figure out to use less of it are the answer. And what's interesting is that burning more and more fossil fuel is almost always, you know, or often because we're becoming more and more and more privatized. So many of the answers are about doing things together. So, yes, it's a good idea to drive a hybrid compared to driving an SUV. It's a much better idea to get on the bus compared with driving a hybrid. It's a much better idea even than that to do what Europeans have done, which is get together with their neighbors and demand that their politicians build a great train network so that they can, without even having to think about it, be innate environmentalists all the time. And you can do that same kind of scale of things in regard to food or almost anything else.
Okay. But, give me another example.
Let's think about another commodity that we all use every day, food, three times a day. Okay. The moment the average bite of food that reaches an American's lips has traveled 2,000 miles to get there, that essentially means that it's been marinated in crude oil before you get it. So start thinking about how to change that. A, maybe you start cooking more, and better yet, cooking for a bunch of people at one time, which means you have your neighbors over or you figure out how to share cooking and have the pleasure of I'm a Methodist, so potlucks are deep in my DNA,
right.
You start eating lower on the food chain because it's clear that, eating lots of red meat is a big problem in terms of the emissions it causes. You start searching out your neighbors to buy food from them. Find the farmers who live near you. Now, maybe it costs a little bit more. Maybe not, because you've knocked out a bunch of middlemen, but maybe it costs a tiny bit more. This is advice for people who still have some margin left. It doesn't work for the poorest people in our society who have to figure out how to scrape by. And it's one of the reasons that the great gulf between rich and poor the world around is now not just a sin, it's an enormous practical inconvenience to getting anything done. But it does allow all of us who still have some set of choices and margin to make those choices, not just in the direction of the what seems environmentally obvious, but in the direction of what builds strong communities. Because in the end, it's strong communities that are efficient, that replace consumptive pleasure with deep human pleasure, that allow us to imagine a future that actually works.
In a 2008 essay for Orion magazine, Bill McKibben wrote this: "Research has shown that when we live on car-filled streets, our number of close friends drops by half. We eat half the meals we used to with friends, family, neighbors. Forget about the flax swingler. Our clothes come through the ether from the mysterious geography of Land's End. We don't need each other anymore, and that's the saddest thing we've done, sadder even than the scourge of climate change, which at least is anonymous and impersonal." He concludes, "The big question for this century may turn out to be how fast we can relearn the skill of neighborliness." Read this entire essay, "Where Have All the Joiners Gone?" and subtitled "A Declaration of Dependence" at speakingoffaith.org. I'm Krista Tippett, and this is Speaking of Faith from American Public Media. Today, Bill McKibben on the moral math of climate change.
Coming up the street, look like he's from my hometown. Look like old Charles Alexander, man. Well, believe it is, but what you say, Gabe?
Well, what you say, Nipper?
Well, what you know, Jim?
Oh, nothing much, boy.
How long you been up here, boy?
Oh, I've been up here about a year and a half.
A year and a half? Well, man, I've been up here a long time myself. I'm going back home.
Well, go on, then.
Oh, I'm going. Get some of them red beans and figures. You remember them sweeper days, Dodger? Get a load of this. This is why I'm going back. All the fair moon shining, the fields below. Darkest grunting songs on the low. You needn't tell me, boy, because I know. It's sleepy time down south. Soft wind blowing through the pine wood trees. both down there live a life of ease. When old Mally falls upon her knees, it's leave it time down south. Oh, steamboats on the river are coming, are going, splashing the night away. You hear the banjos ringing, the donkeys singing, the dance till the break of day. Dear old Southland with a dream is on, take me back to the gal of Joan. Oh, how I'd love to hold her in my arms when it's sleepy time down south.
More from Great Speeches and Interviews after these messages.